Computer, please turn it off, because if I hear it go off, you will be making a contribution to the Common School Fund to help fund our education system. And I give you this one warning to be polite, and after that, I'll just give you a sharp look. If you'd like to sign up, we have sign-up sheets on the side aisle over here on the table. We will not be hearing Senate Bill 261 today in work session because the amendments didn't come back the way the parties asked them to, so we'll reschedule that for another day. And we will take bills in this order today, just to give you a heads up. We're going to take 476 first, then 533, then 441, and then we'll go into our work session on 215 and introduce some committee bills. So I think with that, we can get started. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 476, and Mr. Derek Olson from the House is joining us today. He's the House Education Committee Administrator. Our administrator is out for the next couple of days. So thank you. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 476 provides for the election and appointment of Board of Directors of Mass Transit District in Standard Metropolitan and Statistical Area with a population of 400,000 or fewer individuals, requires the Secretary of State to apportion sub-districts for Mass Transit Districts. You have before you the staff measure summary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Wow. We don't have too many in favor of this bill, but Senator Morissette, I'd like you to come up and explain it. If there's anyone you wanted to bring up with you at this time, that's fine. Otherwise, I'll just bring them up later. And you know the drill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, parts of Lane and Linn County. I live in Springfield. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the purpose of Senate Bill 476 is to elect board members to Lane Transit District. Now, currently the governor appoints board members to both Lane Transit District and to TriMet in Portland, the Portland area. We're not addressing the TriMet district, although I would use the same argument for TriMet as I'm going to use for LTD. I think they're both, in a sense, out of touch, perhaps, with their constituents, and they should be elected, and I'll give the reasons for both of them. We're not dealing with LTD because I don't live in that district, and I would be very happy to work with anyone who does live there to draft a bill to include them next session. I think the same arguments apply to LTD or to TriMet as apply to LTD. First of all, the Lane Transit District has been in existence for a good number of years. I've been involved in ridership issues as a private citizen. I was on the Springfield Council. I served as mayor of Springfield, and I was very much involved in ridership issues, in support of ridership issues, and I still am. I think the district has done a good job. I think that it needs to be improved in terms of constituent services and communication. That's one of the problems. I think the basic problem, though, is it violates, I think, a sacred principle upon which this country was founded, and that is no taxation without representation. Not only can they raise taxes of a variety of taxes. They could go do a property tax. They've chosen to do a business licensing tax. Without the consent of the voters, they didn't give that option to people. The people who are within the district are bound by that particular decision. The other violation, I think, of public trust and in participation is the right to condemn property, which they may be doing more of as the new bus system is fully built out, because there is a problem with right-of-way on the streets. They have been taking property in some areas to put in the bus lane, and they will continue to do that, and that's going to be an object of concern, particularly in Springfield along Pioneer Parkway. I'm not sure where they're going to go. I've been told they're going to take part of the school district property to put in a lane partially. Those are some of the decisions that should be thoroughly discussed at town hall meetings at the district level by elected board members taking input from their constituents. A related issue is whether or not routes are being cut to subsidize other programs. That's been one of the big complaints that I've heard. I think there again, it would be helpful if an elected official in his or her district could meet with the constituents and talk about existing routes, possible cuts, possible expansions, all of the things that elected officials do. Now, throughout Oregon, we have park board districts, we have a variety of utility districts, we have water districts. In Glenwood, we have a Glenwood Water District, a very small district, and all of these people are represented by people who are on the board are elected by the constituents, and they are responsible to the constituents. Now, I have to separate what I'm saying about the main concern that I have is taxation without representation, condemnation without representation from the work of the LTD board. I'm not objecting particularly to the policies that have been put in place, although I feel that there will be growing controversy as the new bus line. It's a fixed route. It's a combination fixed route and a rubber tire route, so it will be on the streets in some places, and they're going to do condemnation in other places. So it's a process thing that I'm complaining about. And in theory, at least, they represent people, but in actuality, if you go on the website, it's hard to find. I don't think you can find a phone number or an email for the people who are chosen by the governor to make these decisions. And so there is a disconnect, a basic fundamental disconnect between the board and the people they represent, and this is my main concern. I'm not here particularly to argue policy decisions. I'm here to argue the process violates a basic principle that we've grown up with. And then the other interesting thing, when you see an elected official and an appointed board, now, who makes decisions for the Department of Education? Who's charged with making decisions? The appointed board or the elected superintendent? That's an interesting dichotomy. The elected superintendent is supposed to work with the appointed board and take direction from the appointed board. However, the elected superintendent is responsible to the people who elected her for making decisions based on sound education policies. So what's the purpose for the appointed board? The board is appointed by the governor. I don't think people on the Board of Education are involved publicly in policy discussion. At least I have never been to a meeting in my area with the person who was appointed to the Board of Education. I've been to a number of meetings with the elected superintendent. So I think if we eliminated the appointed Board of Education, I don't think the system would suffer particularly. So I think that it's the elected official who is responsible under all circumstances for any and all decisions made concerning the jurisdiction, and that includes particularly raising taxes, condemnation, and making important decisions that affect other policy decisions, such as route changes in this case, that affect the constituents. And I think it's abominable that there is not a direct link between the voters and the people who are chosen to represent them. Now, the other interesting thing is, there is a tendency, or at least there was when there was one director of the LTD board back in the 90s who I spoke to at one point about who she would like to have on the board. So I think it's a matter of practice, and it's probably human nature for a director, in this case, to want to influence who applies to the board, who the governor appoints to the board, because the name of the game is collegiality. The name of the game is don't rock the boat. Now, wouldn't it be neat if the city council was selected on a don't rock the boat basis by the city manager? So the city council appoints city manager, and then the city manager selects who's going to be on the council. So it is a very, it can be a very contentious system when we have to elect people to serve and manage multi-millions of dollars and deal with constituent problems. It's nice to be able to serve anonymously almost by appointment and never have to confront the voters personally, never have to worry about going to have, you know, a town hall meeting, having phone calls in the middle of the night and so on. But that is not good public policy. And so my argument is based on good public policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I have just a couple of comments and questions for you. I'm looking at the bill, and I see Senator Plzanski's here, and so we're going to invite him up to join you as well to testify. But we've got five of the six elected Lane County legislators on this bill, which sort of tells me something. But let me just respond to a couple of points you made. Your points, well taken, about little tiny boards have elected officials. The Soil and Water Conservation District has an elected official. EWIB have elected officials. But I do have to take issue with the Board of Ed. They do set policy. In fact, this committee heard about that policy. They're changing the graduation requirements. And when a member of the Board of Education was in here, I said, well, do we have anything to say about what you've done? And he said, well, we do make the rules, and but you can always override them. So we can override what they do, but the Board of Ed makes incredible policy in the state. Now, we get rid of them and leave it all with the superintendent, but the purpose of the board is also to interact with the Board of Higher Ed so that we can have a really good system. But I did also want to talk about one other point. There was a vacancy on the LTD board recently that went vacant for a long period of time because people couldn't agree on who those potential appointments would be. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Answer audibly because we can't get the uh-huh.
You're not checking
mine. No, my court reporter instincts say answer audibly on that, please.
Thank you. yes, they did have someone who applied, a person who applied, and that person didn't seem to be satisfactory to the governor's office or to, well, I don't know if the existing board had anything to do with it, but that person was not selected, which is interesting.
Yeah, there were several applicants, but
there were, several
there were never
well,
agreement
one
on it.
Yeah, yes, there were several, but I spoke to one individual who was very frustrated.
All right, thank you. Well, I want to hear from Senator Plzanski, and then we'll take some more questions from the committee.
Madam Chair, there is one other issue that I think is important to mention, because we do have to have an amendment to this bill. Either have an amendment or a huge fiscal impact to allow the Secretary of State to redistrict, and so that's a huge expense, and so we're going to seek an amendment that would simply have all seven positions elected and not expand it to not shrink it to five districts and two at large, but simply have each of the existing seven districts represented by an elected person.
So you'll go back to the original idea that we've been floating every year we've been in the legislature.
And we will get the amendment and hopefully come back and continue the discussion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Senator Plzanski, welcome.
Interesting.
Is this the first you've heard of that?
That's the first I've heard of that, Chair Walker. So I guess.
Okay. Madam Chair, I apologize. Senator Bowmore said again, we heard this yesterday from the Secretary of State's office yesterday afternoon. This was the first that we had heard of it.
Let me identify myself for the record. It's Floyd Brzezinski. I'm State Senator, Senate District 4, that takes in a large portion of Lane County, Douglas County. And I'm here to give support as an individual as well as an elected official from constituents that have contacted me wanting to see the change. The bill that's currently before you with the 5-2, I felt was one that actually gave representation through the elective process, allowing those five wards or districts, however you want to define them, to allow for individual constituents of those districts to be able to have more direct accessibility and accountability from those who would be elected through that process and representing them. The two other positions that the bill, as in its original form, provide for is for the governor to appoint. My only concern from what I've just heard as to having seven district-wide or system-wide elected officials is that right now we have a requirement that two of those positions are ones that frequent a user of the system, and I believe the other one was maybe someone with a handicap that also uses the system. And I'm only my concern about going to a seven elected position. What type of surety would we have that those special populations would in fact be able to be included? So that's I'll put that on the table. I am here in support because I do believe for many other reasons that Senator Morissette has already put on the record, which I won't belabor, that it is a system that allows for more accountability. I can tell you I did have conversations with a former elected official of Cottage Grove as well as a current elected official of Cottage Grove who both told me on Saturday of this past week that they also supported that the board should have some elected positions that would be more accountable. I know from their perspective of looking at how the system, is, as Senator Morissette has said, is continuing going through, say, modifications, and that they felt that that would give a little bit better voice for their part of the community that is served by the LTD system. The other thing I want to make certain and stress, the people that serve on the board now are very good people. Mm-hmm. They make, I think, have committed their time to this process. I do not want this to be that they're not effective or have the ability to do the work they're doing. I think they've done very well at what they've done. And as Senator Morissette has said, you know, this really isn't to go against them based on policy decisions. It's more on the principles that we have as having more accountability in the system. But a number of the individuals that serve on the board, I know personally, have worked with them. I think they're very good people, and they've done very good work. So I do not want my comments to reflect on my belief that I think the board is not able to do the work. It's just the process that we currently have, how they're in the positions that they're in through an appointment process that is excluding a vote of the individuals who would be, let's say, represented by each and every one of those members if they were chosen through an elective process.
Thank you, Senator. And I think I would concur, not I think, I do concur in your comments about the current board. They are an excellent board. But I've been trying to get this bill through since my first term in the legislature in 1999 for the same reasons. It's the principle of the thing. It's the principle of the issue that if you're going to be taxed, you should be represented by someone that you can elect or unelect. If you're going to have your property condemned, you should be represented by someone that is accountable to you. They're accountable to no one, really, but the governor who appoints them and the Senate who confirms them. So those are my issues that I think both of you share. So yeah. I appreciate that. Any questions from the committee? It's another Lane County issue that my committee is bearing with, but I appreciate that.
Madam Chair, yes. May I clarify just one statement that I made?
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bill Morissette. I use the example of the State Board of Education because, to me, it was always kind of paradoxical that the governor does appoint the State Board and we elect the superintendent. Now, I know that there have been some superintendents who work closely with the board, including our current superintendent. There are other superintendents who do not work closely with the board, and there is a constant antagonism and conflict between the two. And it's really always made me wonder about that system, because we do elect the superintendent and we expect the superintendent to make a lot of these decisions, and the board is like many appointed boards, below the radar. And that's a problem with appointed boards. People don't know who they are necessarily. They don't think of them necessarily as the policymaker. And they expect the elected official to be the one who makes the decisions. But I do understand that the Board of Education is very active, and I do understand that the superintendent works closely with them, as it should be. Sorry, I just wanted to clarify
okay.
that.
Madam
Thank
Chair,
yes,
the other thing, based on your comment, I think it's worth me putting on the record, in 95, my first session, in 97, I actually took a different position. Bill Dwyer, who was senator at that time, actually was, the mover of the bill that you have before you as to wanting to have elected the people. And at that point, I took a position that I guess what we've heard from other people, if it's not broken, why try to fix it? And it's one of those things, I guess, as I got more into understanding what the responsibility of the board was, as well as hearing from constituents as to their inability to have access in those years, that I made a shift in my position as to wanting to see a little bit more accountability. And again, this is not to reflect on the individual members of the board. I think they're wonderful people. We're fortunate that they volunteered their time to serve in that capacity. It's really just the philosophy and on the principle of whether you should have elected officials or appointed people in those positions, making those decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. And I don't see any questions, so I appreciate you coming down. Okay, I'd like to hear from the board. Susan Bann and Mark Pangborn. Can Mark come up with you?
Chair Walker and members of the committee, my name is Susan Bann, and I am in my second term as a member of the Board of Lane Transit District. I'm here today to voice the board's unanimous opposition to Senate Bill 476. We discussed the bill at our February 12th meeting, and after some discussion agreed that there was unanimous opposition to the bill. I joined Lane Transit District Board because I work with people every day who rely on transit to lead independent lives. In my independent professional life, in my real work, I'm an executive director of a private nonprofit that works with very low-income families, homeless families, and adults who are very low-income due to a disability, either a psychiatric disability, severe persistent mental illness, brain injury, or brain injury. These are all households who rely on transit in order to lead independent lives. They're households that rely on transit in order to hold families together, and it was a critical resource for us in doing our work to have transit be responsive to this population. Lane Transit District has been a leader, a national leader, for accessible transportation for some time, and it was that accessibility for both the low-income families we serve and for the adults with disabilities, even with physical disabilities in the brain injury population, that was the motivation for me to apply to be a part of the Lane Transit District Board. Some of you live outside of Lane County, so I'd like to give you a brief overview of LTD and some of our recent accomplishments, but also a tradition of excellence. Lane Transit District is a leading transit district in the country, has been a leader in many different ways. We operate buses in metropolitan Eugene, Springfield, and portions of rural Lane County. The district has undergone significant growth during the past decade, and ridership increasing over that period of time by approximately 70%. Lane Transit District from the beginning has had a history of innovation. It was the first transit agency in the country to install lifts for wheelchair and handicapped riders long before it was required or mandated. We had wheelchairs lifts on all of our buses 5 years before that became a mandate. We also were the first in the country to do group passes for education. We started with the University of Oregon, rolled that program out to Lane Community College, and just this past year are working with the school districts so that middle school and high school students are using public transit to get to school and to get home at the end of the day. We opened the first line of MX, bus rapid transit service that has attracted national attention. We get quite a few visitors coming to look at what we're doing. I'm happy to report that the line exceeded our projections for ridership increases. Weekday boardings are up 46% over previous ridership. And this is a route that goes from downtown Springfield to downtown Eugene. There are certain parts of the corridor that have dedicated lanes. There's transit priority at certain signals, and doors open on both sides. It's quite a thing, and I'd hope you come and see it and ride it sometime. We applied for funds from Connect Oregon. We're successful because we want to expand the MX corridors to reach a different part of Springfield. And we have revamped both the Eugene and the Springfield transit stations so that they are now very accessible for riders. We have transit hosts at our stations so that people who have difficulty using and accessing the transit system because of disabilities, often developmental disabilities or mental illness, there's a transit host program that helps people negotiate. Both Lane Transit District and TriMet are financed by a payroll tax. That tax is paid by businesses. The governor appoints the boards subject to confirmation by the Senate. And this is a system that has been in place since transit districts were created in 1970 by the legislature. Senator Morissette has argued that LTD board should be elected, not appointed, because we fund our operations with tax dollars. Our board, though, feels that the governance structure provides taxpayer representation in several ways. For example, the maximum payroll tax rate is set by the state legislature. That is an elected body. Our board does not set the rate. Our board does not approve that rate. The Senate confirms all of the governor's appointees. The Senate is an elected body. I see our board as trustees or stewards for a public infrastructure that is funded by the legislature, by your choice. Like roads, like bridges, transit is an infrastructure that our community depends upon. And when we are appointed to be stewards or trustees of that infrastructure. Our board meetings are open to the public. We provide frequent opportunities for our community comment on existing and future service needs. At our February 12th meeting, we had quite a bit of public commentary, as we do with all of our public hearings on service changes and rate changes. And I would say that I do get phone calls and emails regularly from the public around issues when people have questions about service, when people have questions about changes in rates. And the most recent one is when people have questions about crosswalks that really are not LTD's responsibility, but sometimes we get called even when City of Eugene is culpable. So our activities are guided by a regional transportation plan. When we planned the MX corridors, it was in response to direction from multi-jurisdictions, Eugene, Springfield, Lane County, and our regional transportation plan. It's not something that LTD does in isolation. We do in response to the elected partners who represent our cities and our county. So I would say in closing that the LTD board opposition to Senate Bill 476 is not an opposition to elections in general. I think we, too, really believe in the principle and the premise of no taxation without representation. Our argument, though, is that we are not the taxing body. We are an accountable, responsible stewardship body that responds to direction from electeds, the electeds of City of Eugene, City of Springfield, Lane County, the state legislature. We simply believe that our current governance structure is meeting the needs of the district and our community, and I would ask that you allow it to continue. And one final comment. I do represent a very low-income population and a disabled population. And those are folks who need to have advocates on the LTD board. And I would say, knowing my colleagues on that board, many of them are motivated to apply for service because of their concerns for populations that would not otherwise be represented. And that's very critical to the success of our transit district. And then General Manager Mark Pangborn is here beside me to also help answer questions if you have questions.
Did you want to add any comments or just be here for questions,
no,
Mr. Pangborn?
No, I'm prepared to answer any questions.
Okay. I'll get to you in just a second, Senator Cruz. Ms. Bann, I do appreciate your service on the board, but I have to ask you this question, and I don't mean it in a rude way. Why do you think that someone else couldn't be elected or yourself couldn't be elected to the board to represent the disabled population and the low income? I don't understand why it has to be an appointed person to represent.
My concern is that our population is, as much as we work very hard with them, is often disenfranchised from the public elected process. For low-income families, their lives are so complex and so confusing that even local news is often off the radar for them. Their focus is on getting groceries by the end of the day, getting kids to and from child care, making ends meet, trying to figure out how to spend, you know, their last dollar at the end of the month on groceries that's going to hold kids through a week. I mean, that being active in an electoral process to promote members on the board is not likely to happen with the population I serve.
I understand that, but at the same time,
who's motivated to run for a board? And why would people choose? I would not run. Personally,
It seems, Ms. Bann, we all run for the legislature.
I appreciate that.
And welcome to our world. But we run, and we run to represent everyone in our district. When I talk about being elected and running for the legislature, my comment, and I truly believe it, is that I'm doing this to represent the people who have no voice and no seat at the table.
And that's what you're doing.
I don't understand why someone can't run for election to the board on that same premise.
They could.
Okay. The second question is, and then I'll turn it over to my committee, is you indicated that you think the governance structure works okay now because the payroll tax is set by the legislature, which is an elected body. But you forget about all those self-employed people. And that's the part that really bothers me, is that you've worked with business, you indicated you got approval from business, but that business didn't include all the self-employed people who didn't start getting taxed until a few years ago, or I don't know how long ago it's been, but all of a sudden I get a statement in the mail that I'm going to start paying a tax that I had nothing to say about. And it wasn't just me, but it's all those small sole proprietors and single business owners who aren't part of a larger business organization who suddenly started getting taxed and had nothing to say. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to that?
I'll turn to
The imposition of the self-employment tax. This is Mark Pangborn, General Manager, Lane Transit District. When the tax was formed established in 1970 by the state legislature, it didn't include a provision for self-employed people. And soon thereafter, probably within 4 years, the issue came up of equity between businesses and between self-employed. And particularly, you would have a corporation where, particularly with law firms and with medical practices, where the principals were self-employed, but they had employees who were part of a corporation. So that the business community raised the issue with the legislature, saying this is not equitable, that in fact we're having to pay a payroll tax and people just by virtue of saying they're self-employed don't, where really they're indistinguishable between the two in terms of how they affect the community and their responsibility. So the legislature imposed the payroll self-employment tax at that time. And this was, you can ask Roger Martin, he probably would be more...
He's on the list.
Yeah,
we'll
so the actual date. But at the time, TriMet went ahead and immediately imposed the self-employment tax. LTD did not. And it probably was a period of at least 10 years before that issue came up in Lane County. And it came up because because, again, for this very same reason, the local businesses who were paying the payroll tax at the time said, this is an equity issue. We're subject to a payroll tax on earnings as businesses for employees, including the principals, yet these people here, by virtue of organizing as self-employed, are not. So the board had quite a few discussions with both the chambers of commerce and as well as the local elected officials, the counties and the cities, and saying, you know, where do we go on it? And the decision was made to impose the payroll tax. Now, you very well as an individual may not have been part of an organization as part of this dialogue, but the board had quite a bit of dialogue and felt really as a matter of equity that they needed to go ahead and include that as a tax.
Yeah, I know that when I got the notice in the mail that I was going to start paying this tax, I called the Department of Revenue and said, how come?
Yeah.
Why all of a sudden am I paying this tax? And they told me, and I said, who gave me notice? I didn't have anything to say about it. And the response was, well, there was a notice in the paper. And I said, that's not good enough. There should have been some kind of a community meeting for all of it. I mean, there's lots of people in Lane County. I mean, Oregon is built on these small, little, tiny businesses and you know, people who sell Amway or whatever out of their home or jewelry or you know, whatever. But they just didn't have a say in what happened to them. So, anyway. I'm going to turn it over to Senator Cruz because we need to speed along here.
Okay.
We've got lots of folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would like just a list of the members of the current board and their kind of representation. I guess I would have concerns if it's an elected board that all of the constituencies that need to be represented might not be. And so if I could get that list, that would help inform me on that. And I guess a shot across the bow here, Madam Chair. We're about to impose a tax on a minority of Oregonians called a cigarette tax that they don't want. So
your shot's well heard. Senator Metzger.
And it's all a good Senator mourning that just before committee here outside. Ms. Bann, I do have a question for you. Senator Morissette brought up an issue about accessibility, not just in the meetings, but outside. So my question is, if I got, like, on the LTD website, would I be able to find you an email address for each of you and a phone number contact? And is that
yes, sir. And I'm sorry, I get phone
you
calls.
You said you did, and
I
so
I get
but
phone calls at home. I get phone calls at work. I get emails at work and at home. There is an email that's an LTD email that Joe Sullivan, who's our staff person, forwards emails to us every day. So yes, and my experiences were very accessible. There you go.
Okay.
That's my experience.
Cause I mean, that's an important part of it. I think all of us who serve, we sometimes will hear from the same people over again, and sometimes we'll never hear from other people. But it's the comfort level knowing that they want to contact us, they can,
right,
without going through a lot of hoops, and that's really important, whether we're appointed or elected, to know that you don't have to navigate a lot of things to see that Susan gets an email from me or, you know, gets the message of a phone call, and that's just a real important part. And I can tell from your testimony that you're actively involved, but I wasn't sure as to whether that was reflective of the rest of your board.
My sense is that it is, because we will frequently have conversations at open, where all of our board meetings are open to the public except when we're in executive session. You know, I think about my colleagues around the table, and all of them have come with issues that are instigated by constituents, and it's rare that we have a board meeting where that kind of conversation doesn't happen, where somebody hasn't heard from so-and-so about, you know, especially, and I think Senator Morissette is actually right on the mark when he says the MX, the introduction of this new transit approach, has certainly stirred public conversation more than we've had in quite some time. So there is an awful lot of conversation about how it is that we're doing things, how the bus operates, what the turns are, you know, so yes, we do get an awful lot of that public comment.
Thank you. That's all. Andrew.
Yeah, thank you. And recently I will state that we had an incident on the MX, the new bus line, where a father's children got left
That's correct.
Behind. On the concrete while he went back into the MX to get the stroller, and there were the children. And so the board and LTD took that issue very seriously, very quickly, and retrained staff, and I don't think we're going to have that happen again.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I hope not.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming. I'm going to hear from Terry Connolly and Jack Roberts now, if you'll come up together. And then after that, I'm going to hear from David Hinckley. And then I've got two more people, and then we're going to wrap this up. Welcome.
Chair Walker and committee members, my name is Terry Connolly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for this opportunity to comment. Our organization is comprised of over 1,200 businesses in Eugene and, in fact, from throughout the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area. Our mission is to promote a healthy local economy. And we have long recognized the important link between our transportation infrastructure and services, including public transit, with the health of our economy and with economic development opportunities that create more jobs for the citizens of our community. I'm here today on behalf of the Chamber to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 476. This isn't the first time we have opposed this legislation. As with previous bills, we don't think changing Lane Transit District's structure of governance is a good idea. Not to mention, we're not aware of any compelling reason why changing to an elected board is necessary. As the Register Guard newspaper recently noted in an editorial, Senate Bill 476 is a solution in search of a problem. Specific to the bill, we are struck by how it treats Lane Transit District separate, differently from TriMet. Both agencies currently have the same structure of governance, and both are funded by a business payroll tax. It's unclear to us why the legislature would want to establish two different structures of governance for virtually two identical transit agencies serving the two largest metropolitan areas in the state. Yes, it is important that we comment on the business payroll tax in context of this proposed legislation. I can assure you this is not a popular tax to businesses, large or small, including self-employed and independent contractors. However, contrary to the notion of taxation without representation as one justification for a need for this bill, there is nothing in Senate Bill 476 that provides any guarantee or certainty that only those who pay the payroll tax will be the people elected to the LTD board or have any representation of their interest when it comes to having oversight of the agency. Because of our organization's sensitivity to the payroll tax, if there were compelling reasons why the governance of Lane Transit District needed to be changed, then in all likelihood, it would be our organization standing at the front of the line requesting the legislature to make those changes. But that is not the case. In summary, this bill is about changing the structure of LTD's governance, but with no guarantee and no proof that doing so will produce a better transit agency, no guarantee and no proof that it will produce a better transit service to current and future riders, and most importantly, no guarantee or proof that those who pay the payroll tax will see better administration of those dollars in the policy and management decisions of the Lane Transit District Board. The process of having the governor appoint and Senate confirm members of the Lane Transit District is a sound process, and our community has been well served by that process. We simply don't see any compelling need at this time to change the governance structure of the Lane Transit District Board. Chair Walker and committee members, thank you again for this opportunity to comment. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Just sort of a rhetorical question, Mr. Connolly. Thanks for coming. That's not the rhetorical question, but what about just appointing the members of the legislature? There's no guarantee that when we're elected, we're going to represent people the way we expect them to, so why not have us appointed by the governor? I mean, come on.
Chair Walker and committee members, to answer that question, you have to go back on the structure of the legislature, how it was founded in Oregon versus the creation of transit districts by the legislature in 1970, I believe. So their formation is very different.
I appreciate that, and that was a silly rhetorical question, but it just strikes me as odd that everyone is so afraid that if the transit district board becomes elected instead of appointed, all of a sudden it's not going to be representative representative of the people that elected them. So with that, Mr. Roberts, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Welcome, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the executive director of the Lane Metro Partnership, which is a nonprofit economic development agency that serves Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County. I think this is the 10th anniversary of my first time testifying against this measure. That's why before people have been supporting this. At that time, I was the state labor commissioner, but I really was familiar with this in my years as a county commissioner in Lane County, where I had a chance to see how LTD operates and to come to respect that, and that respect has grown over the years. I frankly believe that Lane Transit District is as efficient and effective a transit district for a community our size as exists anywhere in the country. And in fact, when I look around the state, and I know that except for TriMet and LTD, which are financed primarily by the payroll tax, the other transit districts, for the most part, are financed by property tax. Most of them have elected boards. I would not trade the Lane Transit District for any of those other transit districts, including the one here in Salem. Now, there are a lot of factors that go into that, but I know when I talk to businesses that are looking at locating in our area or the ones that are there that are talking about expanding or relocating to another part, they take very seriously the access to and the ability to be served by transit. It is something that really helps to define a community. But at the same time, the majority of people don't ride LTD, and an even smaller percentage of them pay the payroll tax. I'm concerned when we try to get people to serve on these boards, and like many of you, I imagine, I've often asked to help recruit people to serve on boards and commissions. It's a constant effort to get people to make that commitment of their time and their effort. By and large, most of them wouldn't run. They're not doing this because they want to start their political career. They're not doing it because they like getting their name in the paper. They're doing it for the same reason that they volunteer for the United Way Board or the YMCA Board or Birth to Three and Relief Nurse and other things. They want to make a commitment to the community, to pay something back, to give of themselves, and they like to spend it dealing with these issues. But the issues are primarily technical. They're primarily management. There was talk earlier about the Board of Education. In some respects, the better analogy is higher education, where there are no elected officials at that level involved. I don't think that any of us would suggest that those decisions would be better made if we elected the members of the Board of Higher Education. I think that we have an elected process for selecting you who set the payroll tax and who in the Senate approved the members who are appointed to this, but by and large, we have a system that works. And my sense in looking at this is that we're not going to be improved by having an elected board, and that the risk is that when you have these fairly obscure offices below the radar screen, there's always the potential that some issue, some small part of what they do becomes politicized. If you were electing the board of TriMet, every 2 years you'd be fighting the ideology of light rail, and you wouldn't be dealing with the functioning of TriMet. And I'm concerned now that we're embarking on the BRT, which incidentally is a phrase that was coined at LTD and now is used across the country for sort of light rail without the rail, without the expense of the embedded system. It's an exciting prospect, but it's a multi-year project that we need to move forward with. Congressman DeFazio is very excited about it and very supportive of it. And if we have to fight these ideological issues at the election time, I think it detracts from what the board really needs to do. So my advice to you is to look at this to see that it is not broke and that you shouldn't break it.
Okay. Any questions of the committee? No, but thank you very much. I appreciate the testimony, and it's nice seeing both of you again.
Mr. Madam Chair, I was wondering if it's the 10th anniversary, if there's going to be coffee and cake outside. I think this is my 8th anniversary of this bill since I've been on transportation. This is the first time it ironically came to a different committee than my transportation committee.
Oh, well,
I wonder how that happened.
This would be the Education and General Government Committee. Okay, I'd like to hear from David Hinckley, and then after David, I'm going to bring up the last two people, Roger Martin and Marcia Kelly. Marcia's with the Salem Transit District, so we'll get a flavor of what's going on in Salem. Welcome.
Thank you, Herman Walker, Senators. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about this bill.
And just state your name for the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. David Hinckley from Eugene, Oregon. In some respects, this seems to be a no-brainer. Local public policy-making bodies should be elected. I mean, what's the problem? We elect city councils. We elect Soil and Water, we select in Eugene, we select the people that run our public utilities. There's been no problem. I spent Well, I guess it's now more running around 12 years as a community activist, neighborhood leader, and the like. My experience has been that elected boards, as a general rule, are more responsive to the comments of the public than appointed ones are. And the further you get away from elected, the less responsive they are. I spent 10 years as a chairman of my local neighborhood association. During that time, I had multiple elected officials, Senator Walker, Brzezinski, Nathanson, or Representative Nathanson, Hovey, have all come and attended our meetings, participated in discussions, as has the city council, the mayor, our eWeb board. Yet to see an LTD board member show up in a meeting. We've seen staff come to push the projects, but we've never seen a board member. Arguments have been made that the system's not broken. I want to argue that that is the first indication that it's broken. That they're sufficiently separated from the public that they don't understand that the public's not happy with the way the policies are being made. That's a problem. Then regarding the tax issue, besides the fact that independent, self-employed people pay the tax as well as businesses, the reality is that the workers are getting less compensation because this tax is coming out of the compensation package available for workers. The other piece of the puzzle is the customer's paying more for the services because it's costing more to provide it. How it's collected, taxes affect everybody. Senator Morissette brought up the addition of taxing and condemnation. I want to throw a third one out. Through EMX or BRT, however you wish to refer to it, LTD is now making changes to the fabric of the community that are permanent. To put the EMX line down through Franklin Boulevard, trees that have been around for a long time had to be cut down. If they continue west through my neighborhood, there's a good chance that changes are going to be made. That's the product of progress. The problem is, how does the public get a chance to get the policy into the policy debate? Which brings us to the other question of politics. Politics is the way we set policy in the United States. We have the debates on the policy issues during the election, and we hopefully get the people that we want, or that the majority of the people want, to push a set of policies. The board sets policy. They have a professional staff that runs the transit district following the policy set by the board. I don't see what the problem is about there being a debate on issues that are concerning the public during the election process. Lastly, there was a question about the cost to having to change this bill because of the cost of redistricting, and that the idea was to have all seven members elected. And the question was raised, then what about the regular user, making sure that a regular user is on the board and a disabled representative is on the board? I'll toss out a second solution to the problem. Change the board from 7 to 9 members. Maintain the existing 7 districts and add 2 seats continuing to be appointed by the governor as for the disabled and the regular user. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hinckley. I appreciate that. Any questions or comments? Thank you for making the trip up from Eugene. I appreciate it. Okay, we'll hear from Roger Martin and Marcia Kelly if you want to come up at the same time. I don't know if you share the same opinion, but it doesn't matter. You can share the same table and be friends.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I've been the executive director of the Oregon Transit Association for 29 years, and this is about the 25th year that this issue has been before the legislature. And the term has been used several times, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That was a comment made quite often by former Governor Attia, and I called him last night to see if he had invented that phrase. He can't remember, but he said he used it a lot. And I honestly think it fits this case very well. I'd like to give you a little background. I was a member of the 1969 Oregon Legislature and chair of the committee that passed ORS 267 that created transit districts. The taxation section of that was written by former state representative Bob Elliott, who has since gone to the big caucus in the sky, and Bill Roberts, who is no relation to the recent speaker, but was the prominent Portland businessman. The tax section included a menu of taxes that amazed all of us at the time, from a sales tax through a property tax through a payroll tax, and the business community in the state did not understand what a payroll tax was and let that pass. Afterwards, two of the most prominent business lobbyists that I ever knew in this legislature, Bill Hedlund, who represented the oil industry for many years, and Bob Knipe, who was the Oregon Trucking Association, said it was the worst mistake they both had made in not trying to stop that. We persuaded them that the provision in the bill to appoint the board was the assurance to the business community that they would have some representation on each of these boards. And for the last 37 years, Lane Transit has had just that. They've had people on the board from the business community who under most circumstances would not have run for the board. And they're the ones that have paid the lion's share of the tax. I find it kind of ironic that we have this bill. In the last 10 years, it's been because of Lane Transit. Because I have to tell you, as a member of the American Public Transit Association, Lane Transit is viewed as one of the outstanding small transit districts in the nation. And I can tell you from the standpoint of the state of Oregon, no system has been better run for the last 37 years than Lane Transit. And I can testify to that. The other good system in the state is TriMet, and they've had their ups and downs simply because of the huge projects they've engaged in and the controversy that sometimes surrounds things like the expansion of light rail. It was mentioned a moment ago that you need elected board because the BRT is expanding and changing the fabric of the community. No BRT line in Lane County is extended without the specific vote of the city council in which it's extended. Springfield and Eugene being the case that are the two that have originated that line. Nationwide, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you need to understand that almost all the large transit systems in this country have appointed boards. There are two exceptions. One is Denver, Colorado, and the other is BART system in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And if you read any reports historically, those two systems have had more controversy and more problems and more corruption because of their elected boards than any of the others in the nation. And it works because we get people appointed to this who are there to do a specialized, and I understand, Madam Chair, your position about elected legislators. You are a general government with many various duties and issues you have to deal with. Transit systems are a specialized form of government, and that's the reason that it works well to have appointed boards. The one board in the state of Oregon I would refer all of you to that is elected is in Medford, the Rogue Valley Transportation District. A picture of a non-functional board for the last 15 years. And ask any legislator from Jackson County, and they'll tell you that, in both parties, that it just drives them up a wall. The Chamber of Commerce is at war. The newspaper is at war with the Rogue Valley Transportation District. They're nice individual people, but together they just haven't been able to work. So for those reasons, the Oregon Transit Association is unanimously also opposed to the bill. We hope you don't pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And Ms. Kelly, I'll hear from you in just in a moment, and we need to be brief because we have to wrap it up, but I just don't want the people out in TV land or in this building to believe that just because those boards in Colorado and California are elected and beset with corruption, that it's because they're elected individuals. And I don't think that's the impression that you're trying to leave
us
with.
I'm only saying that nationwide, the two most controversial boards in the country are the two that are elected. All the rest are appointed.
Just coincidental. Thank you. Ms. Kelly.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify today. I am not here in opposition.
It's your name and who you're representing.
Oh, I'm sorry, Marcia Kelly, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. I'm here as an individual, but I am an elected member of the Salem Area Transit District Board.
Elected? Are you elected, you said? Thank you.
And let me be very brief, and then I can answer some questions, because I've been around this issue for as long as Roger, I believe.
Wow.
My name is Marcia Kelly.
Our board has not met since this bill came out, so we don't have an official position. I'm here to make sure that there is legislative clarification that whatever you do with this bill, that it does not affect Salem. We are formed under a different ORS. We currently have 7 elected board members. I would not like to go down to 5. I already have 7 neighborhood associations that I deal with, plus committees with the Chamber of Commerce or other organizations. In Salem, we are elected. Most of us have jobs, community activities, families. I think we're conscientious. We sometimes have controversy happen in the city because of something that we have done, but like other elected officials, we just work through that. The history of Salem is starting out with county commissioners, city councils appointed, and then members elected, and then we eventually went to a 7-member elected board. 2 of our former members are Senator Peter Courtney and Senator Gene Durfler.
Wow. They got their elected start on the board.
Peter Courtney was appointed as a Salem City Council person, and Senator Durfler was elected. I stand for the board, and I have stood for the board more times than I want to admit, I guess, because I really am passionate about public transit. I was raised in a family without a car, and because of public transit, I didn't feel like I was not able to do anything that the other students could do. So my passion is there to make sure that the service is there, and I don't think that you necessarily have to have someone representing a particular interest to have compassion and make sure that the services are there for those who truly do need them. All of us at some point will probably need them because of our aging population.
All right, thank you. And I bet you go to neighborhood association meetings, do you not?
I do go to neighborhood associations. I have 7 in my... So I don't go all the time. If there's something we're changing or if they ask me, I come, and I sometimes pop in other times.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate the testimony.
Madam Chair, just let me add, there's one distinction here that Ms. Kelly mentioned. They're funded by property tax and not a payroll tax.
That distinction did not escape me.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 476. I appreciate everyone who's come today. We'll see what we'll do with this bill later. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 533, if the Senate President is here. Okay, thank you. Mr. Olson, can you talk to us about what Senate Bill 533 does?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 533 requires the State Board of Education, in consultation with the Department of Human Services, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and the State Board of Pharmacy, to adopt rules for students to self-administer asthma medication. It requires school boards to adopt policies and procedures consistent with rules adopted by the State Board of Education. It absolves certain school personnel from liability for administration of asthma medication under certain circumstances, defines asthma medication, and declares an emergency, becomes effective July 1st, 2007. You have before you members of the committee the staff measure summary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senate President Peter Courtney, I would like you to come forward. We've just learned about your distinguished career as a member of the Salem Transit District Board. Thank you for serving in that capacity. Okay. Who are you? We need to know for the record. Are you going to speak with anyone at your side here, or are you doing this all solo?
Well, is someone? I think someone's here from the American Lung Association. I would like them to come up, please, because if you don't mind, Chair Walker.
I don't. You look a little nervous all by yourself there.
That's so. Why I always sit off to the side. I'm not the...
And, Mr. President, I do want to remind you, we have a no cell phone ringing rule in our committee, and you violated that once before, so I'm just sort of giving you a heads up.
I violated that 100 years ago, and you keep bringing it up.
Of course I do, because you set an example for all of us. All right, Mr. President, what's up?
My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator, District 11. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North.
in Salem at 97303
on the beautiful Willamette River.
Chair Walker, Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Metzger, Administrator Olson, thank you for letting me come here today and testify in support of Senate Bill 533. I'm appearing with representatives of the American Lung Association who asked me to help them introduce this legislation, which stunned me when they told me a situation exists in our schools. I just don't know where I've been. I just guess I didn't know it existed.
Well, you're old, Senate President. You're not in school anymore, right?
That's true, but I thought I knew things. And what this bill does, it allows K through 12 students to self-administer prescribed asthma medication while at school. That's what it does. This legislation would ensure students with asthma have the opportunity to treat attacks, asthma attacks, immediately. Oregon school districts have many different policies regarding self-medication. That's what surprised me. Some districts allow students to carry certain types of medication with them. Other schools have a zero tolerance policy for all types of medication, and what this legislation simply would do is strengthen and standardize school policies regarding asthma and self-medication. You have my written testimony. I don't totally read from it. Apparently, 2006, Oregon Health Teen Survey, approximately 10% of Oregon students have asthma. Asthma is more than just a cough. It is a serious lung disease that causes students to feel sick and tired. It lowers their quality of life and can make learning difficult. This bill is a life-saving measure for children with asthma because of the unpredictability of asthmatic attacks. It is important for children to have immediate access to prescribed medications such as inhalers. Asthma kills 5,000 people annually. Oregon is falling behind the national trend of providing for the safety of students with asthma. 38 states have already adopted similar legislation. So I think I distributed my written statement. I was surprised to learn of this through the work of the American Lung Association. That's why they asked me to introduce the bill. And I hope you'll seriously consider it. We have 198 school districts, and apparently there is an unevenness in terms of policy regarding students who get hit with an asthma attack, whether or not they can immediately have an inhalant or whatever would be the prescribed medication. I'm not a doctor, to try to deal with those attacks, which can really get serious and really cause a student to become incapacitated, and worse, it's my understanding. So that's my statement. I really appreciate you letting me come here today and talk with you about it. I really appreciate, Chair Walker, your willingness to hold a public hearing on this measure.
Thank you, Mr. President, because you're exactly right. A student needs access to that medication. My own daughter had asthma that was induced by pollen allergies in the spring and the summer. She finally had to give up playing softball because every time she'd start running around the bases, she'd get an asthma attack because the pollen count was so high. And you have to have that inhaler right there. Right there to administer it, or you can have serious problems. You can't wait for a school nurse or a teacher to come and assist you. So thank you for bringing this legislation. Let's hear from the two guests we have.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here today representing the American Lung Association of Oregon. Seated next to me is Beverly Stewart, who is the American Lung Association of Oregon's certified asthma coordinator or educator, who was also here to help sort of answer any questions that the committee may have. The American Lung Association of Oregon's mission is to prevent lung disease and promote lung health, and that's why we're bringing Senate Bill 533 to you, because we think it's good public policy for Oregonians. Right now, it's estimated that over 60,000 children in Oregon have asthma, and asthma is the leading cause of missed school days for chronic illness and can easily escalate into escalate to death without prompt medical attention. And due to the time-sensitive nature of an asthma attack, physicians instruct patients to carry prescribed inhalers with them at all times. And schools that restrict or revoke the right for students to self-carry life-saving medication often put themselves and students with asthma at risk. And, you know, one of the things I'll point out is Beverly provided sort of a packet of information, and I was actually going through this packet this morning. There's actually, she has a list of several deaths of students You know, one in particular that struck me was a student, Catherine, who died in the principal's office while her inhaler was sitting just feet away, you know, a couple feet away, locked up in the principal's, the medical medicine cabinet. So, and it's not just also about students, you know, with, you know, asthma. It's also about other students. I mean, imagine, you know, a student who has an asthma attack and is gasping for air in a classroom, and how traumatic it is to the other students, how disrupted it is. And also is puts teachers and school administrators in a position where they have to deal with a life-threatening emergency. 38 states currently have statewide policies giving students the right to carry and self-administer inhalers and EpiPens in schools. And additional 4 states, including us, are now sort of working on pending legislation. Oregon law currently states that the school board shall develop policies and procedures that provide for self-medication. But, you know, mere guidelines, you know, do not necessarily always protect the rights of children in every school. And tragic refusals of some schools to allow students to carry their medications can result in death and other sort of issues. So, you know, discrepancy results in some school districts prohibiting students to carry their life-saving medication, students in classrooms, riding on school buses, participating in before or after school activities or on playgrounds may have difficulty in immediately accessing their medications. These students are at constant risk of an attack that can come from a change in the weather, exposure to plant or animal or mold or fumes or chemical spills, fresh paints. I mean, the list can go on and on. So Senate Bill 533 simply calls for strengthening and standardizing of self-medication carrying law that follows sort of the federal guidelines, which is the Asthmatic School Children's Treatment and Health Management Act of 2004. I did have a conversation this morning with Jim Green from the School Boards Association. There was an issue in the bill in terms of, it's not right in front of me, requiring schools to carry that asthma medication. It was our intention that parents would provide this medication to the schools. In no way did we intend for schools to go out and have to purchase this medicine, so we would amend the bill to state that parents should provide it to the student.
That
so,
makes sense.
Essentially, in wrap up, this bill will ensure the earliest access and administration in the midst of an asthma attack. It will help ensure that the child goes back to the child instead of being sent to the emergency room. So on behalf of the American Lung Association of Oregon, I ask you to support Senate Bill 533 and have Oregon join the 30 other states who have this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Okulich. You mentioned EpiPens, and that brought up something in my mind. My husband's severely allergic to bee stings and ended up in the hospital one time, so he carries an EpiPen with him everywhere. And our son, when he was younger, had that experience as well. This bill doesn't, I see it relates to asthma, so you don't address EpiPens. Is that coming in some other legislation in the future? Or?
Chair Walker, I believe that it is actually covered in the bill. I know that, and Beverly can maybe help out here. I know that,
okay.
I think that EpiPens were prescribed sometimes for asthma attacks. I don't know how common that is anymore.
Well, you don't necessarily, I mean, if you get a bee sting, you go into anaphylactic
right.
shock, so it's not asthma, but you use an EpiPen for that. So, but I see someone nodding that maybe we'll talk about that. And that is just absolutely tragic about the child who died in the principal's office. You know, when those children, especially the younger ones, have an asthma attack, they panic if they can't get their medication, and then when they panic, because the doctor kept counseling Sarah not to panic, but they panic, and then they can't breathe, and it gets even worse, more difficult to breathe, so then everything just stops working properly. So, thank you. Ms. Stewart, you want to talk about something here today?
I'm just here to answer questions
okay.
if you have any more.
Okay. Well, we've got some people that have been nodding their heads in the back, and I think they're going to be testifying. So, Mr. President, did you have any other comments? Any comments from the committee?
Yeah.
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, your point about people with bee stings, I'm not sure this legislation would allow somebody with that allergy because it is pretty narrow relating clause, so that might be something we'll need to look at, but because that's another emergent situation that needs to be dealt with. I'm just not sure it can be dealt with in this bill due to the relating clause. But I want to thank the President for bringing this forward. I was amazed myself, and Mr. President, you seem to catch these little things that we have somehow overlooked or omitted or something like that in law that really are help people protect themselves, and I appreciate your hard work on these issues, because this isn't the issue of the session, obviously, but these are kids' lives we're talking about, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you
both, or all three of you.
Mm-hmm. Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, one of the things that Beverly just reminded me of was we had talked a little earlier about maybe trying to amend the bill to also include the sort of the animal ethics situation that you just mentioned.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure you can because of the relating clause, so we may need to look for another vehicle.
But talk to counsel about that because we might be able to squeeze it in there, but I doubt it. But do talk to them. All right.
Good.
Thank you. I'd like to hear from three nurses now. They're probably the ones that have been nodding their heads. So Carol Zirkel, Gail Wiebe, and Kathy Patterson, if I did that right. And then after you testify, we'll hear from the Oregon State Board of Nursing and then wrap this one up and move on to our next bill. Hi, just the first of you that wishes to go.
Hi, my name is Carol Zirkel, and I work for Willamette ESD. I am the special needs nurse for our Birth to Five Early Intervention Special Education Group, Early Special Education Group. I started in the position years ago as the only nurse for three counties, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties, birth to 21-year-olds. And so I've come a long ways to being able to narrow down to the younger population, but I'm still involved with Birth to 21 in the three counties. I'm speaking today because I'm the new president for Oregon School Nurses Association. We come in complete agreement with the American Asthma Association that it is a vital thing that students be able to access their self-medication. However, we found some real concerns within the legislation that we wanted to address. One of them they brought up themselves in Section 1, Item D, the quote that says a requirement that schools have asthma medications available for emergency use needs to be clarified, because that brought up the issue to us. Are we as a school district going to be responsible for providing that medication? If so, who is going to prescribe it? Who is going to monitor it? And my last point down there, who is going to assess to determine the child's condition that the medication needs to be given? And that's strictly limited by the Oregon State Board of Nursing, that a nurse has to do that activity. It is our stand that for children to be safe in school because of asthma and the multitude of other chronic health conditions, that a school nurse is necessary. Specific to asthma, in Section 2, the bill speaks of the civil and criminal liability. The quote in the bill is, in compliance with the instructions of a physician, physician's assistant, nurse practitioner, or clinical nurse specialist, in good faith, administers prescription medications to a pupil pursuant to written and instructions of the pupil's parents or guardian. The actuality in the schools that we have in Oregon is that, sadly, there is not a lot of parental involvement for a lot of reasons. I'm not going to go there, but there is not. We have children with asthma, and we strive and we work hard just to get their asthma inhalers to school because parents don't send them. Who's going to monitor that? Who's going to track that? Who's going to work with schools to help them to access even the medication that this child may need? The example that I have for that is, and it may be totally well-meaning parents, totally well-meaning physicians. But what happens, say your child is first diagnosed Saturday, they have a crisis, they go to the emergency room, they're issued the inhaler, the epinephrine, whatever it is that they need to protect themselves at school. That child shows up at school Monday morning. You have not been at, you may have been told some things, but you were not adequately trained regarding the medication or the interactions or the safety of its use. And this happens over and over and over again in our schools. The child shows up, the inhaler, and I brought a prop because it's so important. It's so very important. The inhaler shows up at school. The EpiPen shows up at school. It's set on the desk of the secretary. Here, my child needs this, and the parent leaves. Or it comes to school in the child's backpack. When I first started nursing, for school nursing, a local district, I went in to train on my first EpiPen for a severe allergic reaction. The school nurse at that particular school opened up her drawer, and there were five or six of these in that drawer. The school secretary, what did I say? I'm sorry. I'm nervous. The school secretary opened up the drawer of the desk. There were five or six of these sitting there, and she says, oh, that's what those are for. It happens over and over and over again. We are in support of this legislation, but because of the severity of the illnesses, chronic illnesses, not just asthma, but diabetes.
I was just wondering about diabetes. Do we
there
allow children to prick themselves and administer that?
We did that.
Okay. Yes. And your current law allows for student self-medication in the schools. And I agree wholeheartedly with what was said before. There is a huge discrepancy not only with asthma medications, but with other emergency life-saving medications. Rectal diastat for a child that is in constant seizure activity. It is allowed to be given in Oregon schools. We have districts. I have one district that has adamantly refused. Nobody in our district will administer that medication because last year they had to deal with sexual abuse charges with a student. Mm-hmm. And so now everybody is afraid because of where this medication has to go to save a student's life. Mm-hmm. They have adamantly refused to administer it. So there is a discrepancy. My bottom line is that there is a huge complexity of issues, not just asthma, but diabetes. Severe allergic reactions where EpiPens are needed. This doll that I hold, I use every day for training. I have students with tracheotomies that get suctioned in school. I have multiple students that get fed through tubes in their tummies at school every day. We have kids that come to school that have had cancer. I'm not going to open her diaper. We have children that we catheterize at school. There is a multitude of issues that are dealt with. Asthma is primarily important. It's very important. This legislation speaks specifically to asthma. It needs to be more global. Our current medication administration, ORS, in the state speaks to these things. Your next legislation or your next group that's going to come to you is the American Diabetes Association. Well, what about all the myriad of things? Mm-hmm. And so our contention is that to keep... And it's not self-serving. I don't want a job. I have more of a job than I can handle. It's not self-serving. But to keep the kids in Oregon safe, we need school nurses. Healthy People 2010 is coming up very quickly from the United States government. And in Section 7-4, it says that one of the goals is to increase the proportion of the nation's elementary, middle, junior, and senior high schools that have a nurse-to-student ratio of at least 750:1 for regular ed students. Oregon is somewhere between 1 and 3,500 and 1 to 5,000, and there are some districts and areas that have absolutely none. The coordination that is needed to keep a child safe at school is huge, and we maintain that it takes a professional school nurse to do that. My colleagues have some wonderful things to share regarding that.
I'm going to have to cut it really short because we're really running out of time, and we've got two other bills. So I know this bill needs some amendments, so just give us the highlights of what you want to say. And
well, yeah, Madam Chair, with this relating clause, this deals with asthma, so we need to keep the discussion there. But I'm kind of, and I understand the more global aspect, but that can't be done here. Mm-hmm. So, or I don't believe so, but I guess I have some confusion, Madam Chair. If a child with asthma is out playing, he's got his inhaler or whatever with him, he self-administers if he needs it. They learn how to do that. I'm not sure need nurses to do
that.
Why don't we just focus on that? We all want school nurses, but we can't go there in this bill. So let's just focus on what the changes are in this bill that you'd like to see, if any.
I've got some handouts. I'm not sure what the procedure is for that.
So the administrator can get those.
Specifically to Bill 533, first of all, I sat with a child, a couple days ago, who was struggling to breathe.
And state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Gail Wiebe, and I've been a pediatric nurse for for 20 years, and I've been practicing in the school setting for about eight years. And I thank you for considering this bill, because I think it has a great intention, and I think it's going to be a good bill. Some of the potential pitfalls in the language of the bill might actually undermine the intention of the law. And my understanding is that the law is an effort to put the emergency asthma meds in the hands of the student for life-saving results. In regards to that intention that we're trying to do, first of all, I, as a school nurse, we cover about 1 to every 3,500 students. So it's not my philosophy or intent that I'm going to be there for every child who's having an asthma attack to try to administer their medication. That's not even in the realm of possibility.
Right.
Down at the bottom, you'll see what the role of the school nurse is, which is to evaluate the need, the health need of a student, develop a plan to address the need, implement the plan, and evaluate the plan on an ongoing basis. That involves training school staff what to do. It can involve training kids what to do, so they can self-advocate. Some of the pitfalls that I see in this bill with the language the way it's written, which is point number two under some pitfalls. The way that Section 1 is written may make it more difficult for students to access their inhalers in an emergency rather than facilitating the process. In Section 1A, that talks about a written statement from the student's physician that provides information about the student's asthma meds, time and special circumstances under which the student may self-administer asthma meds. I suggest that a written statement from the MD be allowed to be considered the prescription label on the inhaler, because what we find, and this is just in the trenches kind of stuff, but what we find is there's going to be a delay of time, or perhaps it will never actually occur, that you're going to get a written statement from a physician that says they can carry and self-administer their inhaler.
And the little piece of paper from the physician.
A prescription.
Yeah,
that has that
instructions.
That has that separate information on it.
Right.
Okay.
If we consider the RX label to be the written instructions from the physician, albuterol inhaler, 1 to 2 puffs every 1 to 2 hours or 2 to 4 hours is needed for wheezing, then I think the kids will get the inhaler quicker.
Okay. And your second point?
Second point B, under B of Section 1, is documentation. The student has a skill level to self-administer. This is huge. And I don't have a statistic, and I wish I did. I've asked, and it doesn't exist to my knowledge. But from in the trenches, when I go around to my schools, and I deal with especially elementary but sometimes secondary kids, show me how you use your inhaler. So you're having an asthma attack, show me how you're using your inhaler. And well over half the time, there are some big deficits in administration technique, which will decrease the efficacy of the medication.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's an important piece. However, in the legislation, the way it's written, that is under the physician's job, the way I read it. Well, the doctor's not going to write a note that says that they have the ability to self-administer, because they're dealing with a lot of 5-minute visits. Mm-hmm. A lot of these kids go to ER.
Okay.
That's not something that's going to facilitate kids getting their inhaler at school and self-administering. So a suggestion I had was documentation that the student can self-administer may be better obtained from, and I listed all the people that are in the bill so far, mm-hmm. or a school nurse. We're not as available as I'd like us to be, but we're more available than the ER physician. Many times these meds are prescribed by an ER covering physicians. We've already talked about that. A prescribing practitioner seeing a student on a one-time basis, let's take your uninsured, your migrant population, whatever, they've got an inhaler. The inhaler made it to school. Yay, it's got their name on it. Oh, my goodness, that's fantastic. Okay, let's be able to use it.
Okay.
Let's not have to go back to the doctor for that note.
The final point we've already addressed.
And then D, provided by the parent and guardian has been addressed. The other thing that I see is that you're going to want to consider, I think, is Section 2, the liability section, where people who give the non-prescription meds, which there I can't think of a non-prescription med that's actually used for asthma, but for an emergency in asthma, but let's just say something comes later. My suggestion for the change in that language would be not liable if given non-prescription meds in good faith and per training to a pupil pursuant to written permission instructions of the pupil's parent guardian when consistent with the manufacturer's instructions. More frequent or higher than recommended doses require a prescription, because we have parents who, for whatever reason, direct school personnel, secretaries who don't have any medical background and don't understand medication, side effects, and dosing. They will instruct them, and this happens all the time, to give something that is actually not safe for a child to have.
Okay.
So that would be another suggestion.
All right. Well, it's clear we need a lot more work on this bill, but I want you to sit down with the drafters because you all have some real expertise. Ms. Patterson, did you agree with those suggested changes? State your name for the record,
I do.
Please.
My name is Kathy Patterson. I am mm-hmm. a school nurse and have been for almost 25 years. And the thing that I would like to add to everything that they've said is in Section 1 under number 4A, where it's talking about the administration by trained school personnel, I'm not certain if they are looking to have additional asthma training in this law as a requirement. I'm not clear about that. The school medication administration law already states that people have to be trained before they can administer, and now they are required to do yearly update training as they are allowed to administer medication in school. I'm not certain if this is asking that there be additional training, so I would just like to ask that that point be clarified. And I'm very grateful that they are interested in including epinephrine for severe allergies as well, because that was a huge concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you, all three of you. I'm going to quickly bring up Marilyn Hudson. It says you don't have any written testimony. You have questions. Ms. Hudson, it's clear. Come on up, please. I need to really cut this off because we're not going anywhere with this bill today. But you had you state your name for the record, why don't you do that right now?
My name is Marilyn Hudson. I'm the RNLPN practice consultant for the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Great. Now, it says that you had questions. Were some of the questions some of the things that were raised today?
I think it's largely been addressed. I do have a question about one particular section, Section 1, 3D, which has been discussed, a requirement that schools have asthma medications available for emergency use, and what the intent was with that, if you know what the intent was, because if the intent is to provide for maintenance of stock asthma medications, then there are a lot of questions that would have to be answered regarding proper storage, administration, dispensing, which would not be within nursing authority and that kind of thing. So that then there's some questions about, you know, roles, I think, within this, what the nursing role would be, which probably could be addressed during the rulemaking process. But that was the predominant question that I had, and I didn't know if there was an answer right now or if that it's mainly to just raise that concern.
Well, that's just raising the concern is fine. I'd like you all to work with Mr. Coolidge, is still in the back of the room, and Senator Courtney's office, and bring this back with some amendments that
Madam Chair. This is one of the things that just frustrates the heck out of me about the legislature. And we're dealing with children who have asthma. They're in school 6-7 hours a day. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time they're not in school, but they have asthma 24/7. So they're already knowing how to take care of themselves. you know, I don't have asthma, but when I go get a prescription, either the doctor or the pharmacist tells me how to administer. And for us to set up a bureaucracy for a kid to be able to use an inhaler, it seems absurd to me. What I'm hoping the finished product is streamlining the way for a child to be able to take his inhaler, put it in his pocket, go to school. If he needs it, use it.
If I could just make a comment, part of the problem is you're also dealing with very small children who are not capable of making those decisions for themselves, and so we would have to have something that would be useful.
Madam Chair, my question would be, when they're out playing and they've got it with them, who's making that decision for them? The other three-fourths of the time that they're in existence when they're not in school, you know.
All right, Senator Cruz, okay. I know what you're talking about here. So thank you for your testimony. We'll bring this bill back when we've got some work done on it. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 533. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 441. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Chair Walker. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 441 deletes provision requiring that one-third of mutual wagering receipts paid to the Oregon Racing Commission be deposited in the general fund. You have a staff measure summary before you, members of the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Athena, do you want to come on up and bring whoever you wanted to testify? It appears we have no one in opposition to this bill, so if you can all just give us the update and what it's all about. Betsy Johnson, is that Senator Betsy Johnson?
She was in here a minute ago.
Okay.
They went to get her.
Okay, great. Thank you. State your name for the record and tell us why you need this bill.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Athena Zeke. I'm a lobbyist with the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, and I'm sick, so pardon my voice.
I'm sorry.
I sound worse than I feel.
Okay.
To my knowledge, this bill is supported by the entire racing industry, because what we would essentially be doing is retaining money instead of sending it to the state general fund, and we have many, many things that we use this money for. You've got some handouts in front of you. If you want to glance through that real quickly, the money is coming from the national hubs that are licensed to operate in Oregon, and they tax the amount of money that goes through these wagering hubs. And that's I was just speaking with the Racing Commission acting director, and he said that in the calendar year of 2006 that equaled approximately $2 million, and we retain two-thirds of that in the Racing Commission, and one-third goes to the state general fund. So we're simply asking that we don't pay the one-third into the state general fund so that we can continue our racing development programs, which support race meets at county fairs across Oregon, as well as Oregon bred programs, which keep people breeding horses in Oregon, which keeps the farms here and the people that work on the farms. And the Jockey Incentive Fund keeps the jockeys riding all year round. They get paid all year round, as well as help supplementing some purse money at Portland Meadows when we're running the Class 1 race meet up there, because we have the dubious distinction of running for the lowest purses in the nation. My colleague here, Dick Cartney, could speak a little bit about some of those things if you have any questions for me.
Okay. So no, we'll let you preserve your voice and hear from Mr. Cartney.
Chair Walker, members of the commission committee, my name is Dick Cartney. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent Protective Association. The organization I work for represents approximately 1,500 members who own, train, and race thoroughbred racehorses in Oregon. Horsemen in Oregon have struggled in recent years to survive. primarily because their expenses have risen dramatically while their revenues have not been able to keep pace. Currently, as Athena said, our purses that we race for in Oregon are among the lowest in the country. One development that has been a great help to us has been the money that's been generated by the 0.25% tax on the multi-jurisdictional hubs that are currently located and licensed in the state of Oregon. Under the direction of the Oregon Racing Commission, a majority of these funds have been directed to the smaller county fair race meets in Oregon. Without those funds, I think it's safe to say that a number, if not all, of those race meets, smaller race meets, probably would have gone out of business by now. Some of the things they've been able to use these funds for are to increase purses, to make capital improvements such as building barns, stable horses, to purchase equipment to maintain the racing surface in a safe manner, and to also to provide incentives to jockeys to remain in-state instead of going somewhere else where they have more lucrative purses. Unfortunately, there's a lot more needs than to keep racing going than there are revenue. Senate Bill 441 would allow some of the money that is generated by the racing industry to stay in the racing industry to help meet those needs. So, therefore, I respectfully ask that you would support Senate Bill 441.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? I appreciate the testimony. Racing, horse racing is a beautiful sport. It's quite a skilled sport. I'm very impressed that a jockey can do that kind of work, and we should keep them doing their job instead of having to send them out to work at a McDonald's to supplement their salary. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree.
Yeah, I do too. All right, well, thank you. We'll hear from Senator Betsy Johnson next. I'm kind of curious to see what her interest in this is.
We also had one other request that if this bill makes it out of this committee, that we send it down to Ways and Means. It did not come out with a subsequent referral, but it is a fiscal impact.
Oh, yeah.
So we request that.
Yeah, it's taking money out of the general fund. Yeah. So
thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
I picked right up on that part.
Madam Chair, I brought reinforcements.
Oh, you did you? Okay.
Yeah, that's because you're so shy and retiring.
That's right. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, home of Tillamook and the Tillamook County Fair. And the chair characterized horse racing as a beautiful sport. It's also one of the single most exciting things in local fair venues where there is racing, to stand right next to the fence and to see these 1,000-pound animals come pounding down the racetrack. It is a thrilling sport to observe, but more than that, it is an economic driver of monumental proportions in rural Oregon. This is a little bill. It has a de minimis fiscal effect in a $40 billion give-or-take-all-funds budget, and it makes the difference, all the difference in the world to the little communities. These are communities in eastern Oregon, far eastern Oregon, central Oregon, Senator Westland came in right on cue, and the coast. What we're really talking about here is the survival of parimutuel racing in some of these locations. With me is Jerry Underwood, the director of the Tillamook County Fair, the 100-year-old Tillamook County Fair. And for 100 years, horse racing has gone on there. We have bleachers that are just about that old. And in the absence of the money that we're talking about being reinvested in the sport of horse racing, there won't be any place for anybody to sit, ergo no racing. If my own family is any indication, for nearly 40 years, my in-laws drove up from Central California to attend the Tillamook County Fair to participate in not only the horse racing but the pig and Ford races. These are huge economic drivers in little communities. We pay a lot of lip service to helping rural Oregon in this building. This little bill really does help rural Oregon on the ground, and so I would commend it for your consideration and deeply appreciate your affirmative action on it.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Underwood, will you state your name and what you're here for?
Yes, Chair Walker and members of the Education Committee. My name is Jerry Underwood, and I'm the manager of the Tillamook County Fairgrounds. I live at 610 Ginger Avenue in Garibaldi, Oregon. First of all, I wanted to let you know Betsy and I really are good friends, but I promised to stay away from her because I lost my voice last night. So
it seems to be catchy around here.
Someone lose this bill? We wish Betsy would lose her voice.
But I would just like to say I appreciate being able to testify before you. This Senate bill that's coming up is important to the horse racing for the whole industry, but I represent one of the five summer race meets, and racing at Tillama County Fair is an integral part of our fair. It brings people in the early part of the fair, and you know the economic impact is substantial, and not only from what we give back to persons to the horse owners and the trainers and the jockeys, but right down to the food vendors that are you know paying to be parts of the fair. But this Senate bill, is allowed to pass. Tillama County is in a situation right now where our grandstands were given, they're 78 years old, they were given this year, at the end of this fair, one way or the other, those grandstands are coming down. The county is committed to a long-term loan. We tried to do a levy, and that didn't work and probably will not work with all the other money matters that are taking place. We have come up with some ways that we think we are going to be able to finance those grandstands, tying in with a community college bond levy that they're going to build on a piece of the property adjacent to the fairgrounds. Leaving that alone, I just want to testify that thank you for letting me be here, and please support Senate Bill 441 because it will really help. There's a lot of safety issues that all the five summer race meets are facing. Each time we have the race meet, at the end we get a letter from the stewards and from the Racing Commission, and there's a long list that we all have, from facilities to fences to so safety, I think, is a key issue. And speaking for the summer race meets, we really want to thank what the Oregon Racing Commission has done. They have kept racing alive in our fairs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Underwood. I appreciate it. I own a second home in Tillama County, so I'm a very big supporter of what you do over there. And along with Senator Johnson, I agree. It is what keeps these rural communities going. The county fairs are exciting and a place for the whole family, and I don't want to see them go away. So thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Well, I have
Senator
one.
Metzger?
Senator Johnson, I don't know if this is your sub. I mean, your familiarity with the Oregon Racing Commission. I just kind of wonder what its budget currently is in ballpark terms for administering its duties.
They end up contributing, Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, they end up contributing right now about $1 million to the general fund, and they run the rest of the operation on a very modest budget. I don't have the number right in front of me.
Okay. Is that follow-up? Is that commission part of your purview?
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I'm asking the administrator to check with the president's office. There's no subsequent referral on this bill, but it has a fiscal impact, so we're going to check and see what kind of motion we need. Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to echo Senator Johnson's and Mr. Underwood's comments. I've been to the Tillama County Fair many times as the guest of Ed, God rest his soul, and Lois Ball. I mean, two of the finest people I've had the privilege to have known. And the job you do there is just incredible. And while every county fair has its own flavor and dynamic and particular place in all of our communities, you are not only be commended but congratulated for the exemplary job you do down there. It's really quite a sight, and it's without question a significant part of the fabric and culture of the community. So thank you for your work and your service, sir.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, while you're waiting for the technical assistance from the professional staff, this scenario plays itself out in Grants Pass, out in Union, Prineville, and Harney County Fairs as well. Mr. Underwood has been very successful in leveraging all kinds of volunteer participation in helping to rebuild the grandstands, the donation of lumber, the donation of cement products, the donation of just grunt labor. They've got a funding plan in place. You too could buy a piece of the Tillama grandstand if that warmed your heart as a home decor addition. But the point that I'm making here is that county fairs, in my experience, are becoming in urban areas increasingly anachronistic. These are the ones that are still alive, and your positive action on this bill helps guarantee that they'll stay alive. The ripple effect from the racing part, feed stores, furriers, veterinarians, the ripple effect is huge. That transcends just the box office where people are standing in line to buy a ticket and come into what you correctly characterized as a family a venue. And so this really is tangible, legislative support for rural Oregon.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both. I'm going to quickly call up Rob Douglas and John McCauley. And, gentlemen, I'm going to just give you a couple minutes because you're in support of the bill. I think the committee supports you. And we've got two matters we need to get done before we adjourn.
Probably more interesting if Mr. Douglas was against the bill.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. It's been my pleasure to represent the thoroughbred breeders since 1978. Briefly, we support this legislation. We believe the Racing Commission has done a good job, has been a good steward of these revenues, and we think this bill gives them the flexibility to do their job going forward. So we support the bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCauley representing the Oregon Fairs Association. You have already heard the number of fairs who would benefit from the passage of this legislation. We just want to go on record as supporting it for the reasons you've already heard.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I think we're happy. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 441. And Senator Cruz has a motion for me right now because I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 441.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 441 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Perfect. Senator Cruz moves that Senate Bill 441 be moved to the floor of the Senate and that we request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion on that? No discussion? Then would you call the roll, Ms. Gravel, just because we haven't heard from you today?
Aye.
Oh, he's excused. He's sick today.
Aye.
Vice Chair.
Aye.
Chair Walker. Aye. Senate Bill 441, having received the majority, passes and moves to the floor. Okay, colleagues, we've got to hurry up here. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 215. Tell us what's going on with that, Mr. Olson, if you would.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Walker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 215 allows school districts to admit students up to the age of 21, defines person in parental relationship for determining school district residency, permits students whose residence is determined by public or private agencies to stay in a school district attended prior to placement until the end of that school year, and rescinds provision governing residency of children with disabilities. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. Would you like me to speak to the -1, -2 amendments?
Yes, would you please?
The -1 amendment retains the provision that permits students whose residence is determined by public or private agencies to stay in school in a school district attended prior to the placement through the end of the highest grade level offered. The -2 amendment retains the provision governing residency of children with disabilities.
Okay. Is
Thank
there
you, Madam Chair.
Anyone here that wants to speak to either of those amendments? I think, colleagues, we know what they're about. We restored the language that the disability advocates were uncomfortable with leading. And
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 215.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 215. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 215.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 215. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 215 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 215 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Discussion? Call the roll, please. Heather?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice
Chair Cruz? Aye. Chair Walker? Aye. Senate Bill 215 will move to the floor of the Senate. Thank you. Who would like to carry that bill today? Volunteer? Senator Metzger, you didn't say anything.
Thank you. I enjoy always volunteering.
I know it. All right. The next thing we have to do is open a work session on committee bills to be introduced. Colleagues, you know the drill. We don't have to approve of these individually, like you love them, hate them, whatever. We're just going to introduce them as committee bills.
Madam Chair, I move LC 2548, LC 2855, LC 2045, LC 3424, and LC 3009 be introduced as committee bills.
Is that 3009 or 3909?
3009.
Okay.
It would be 3009.
Okay, great. And that includes the one we were just handed.
Correct.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the following be introduced as committee bills. LC drafts 2045, 2548, 2855, 3009, and 3424. Any discussion? Any objection?
So ordered. Thank you. Wow, we did it.
Amazing.
It's 10:12.
And down the stretch they came.
We got 3 minutes to party.
Yeah.
You always pull it in at the end, and we were able to get by because Senator Westland showed up late, so that sped things up.
Yeah,
so.
All right.
That's probably true.
Okay, kids. We're off to Ashland tomorrow, as you all know.
8 inches of snow overnight, I was just told.
Oh, you're kidding.
Senator Bates said.
They closed I-5 for a while.
Yes.
But that's south of Ashland, so.
We're not going to go over that mountain. That goes over Shasta. So, no, we're still on. So,
the eyes. Did you see how big her eyes got on
that? You know, I'll have my husband go make sure that we have the proper chains for my vehicle. We got a new car, and so the old chains don't fit. So, we'll take care of it.
Cool car.
Yeah, very cool car. Hybrid. So, colleagues, anything else for the good of the order? We're out of here, if not.
See you mañana.
Okay. See you then. Good night.